Chapter 10, Festive Cycles and Arrangement of the Calendar. Then sought they for Jesus, and spake among themselves, as they stood in the temple, What think ye, that he will not come to the feast? John 11:56. The number 7. The symbolical character which is to be traced in all the institutions of the Old Testament appears also in the arrangement of its festive calendar. Whatever classification of the festivals may be proposed, one general characteristic pervades the whole. Unquestionably, the number 7 marks in Scripture the sacred measure of time. The Sabbath is the 7th of days. 7 weeks after the commencement of the ecclesiastical year is the Feast of Pentecost. The 7th month is more sacred than the rest, its firstborn or new moon being not only devoted to the Lord like those of other months, but specially celebrated as the Feast of Trumpets, while 3 other festivals occur within its course, the Day of Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles, and its octave. Similarly, each 7th year is sabbatical, and after 7 times 7 years comes that of Jubilee. Nor is this all. 7 days in the year may be designated as the most festive, since in them alone no servile work was to be done, while on the so-called minor festivals, that is, on the days following the first of the Passover week and of that of Tabernacles, the diminution of festive observances and of restrictions on labor marks their less sacred character. The 3 cycles. Besides this general division of time by the sacred number 7, certain general ideas probably underlay the festive cycles. Thus, we may mark 2, or else 3, such cycles. The one commencing with the Paschal sacrifice and ending on the day of Pentecost, to perpetuate the memory of Israel's calling and wilderness life. The other, which occurs in the 7th month of rest, marking Israel's possession of the land and grateful homage to Jehovah. From these 2 cycles, the Day of Atonement may have to be distinguished as intermediate between, applying to both, and yet possessing a character of its own, as Scripture calls it, a Sabbath of Sabbatism, in which not only servile work, but as on the weekly Sabbath, labor of any kind was prohibited. In Hebrew, 2 terms are employed, the one moed, or appointed meeting, applied to all festive seasons, including Sabbaths and new moons, the other, chag, from a root which means to dance or to be joyous, applying exclusively to the 3 festivals of Easter, Pentecost, and Tabernacles, in which all males were to appear before the Lord in his sanctuary. If we might venture to render the general term moedim by tristings of Jehovah with his people, the other would be intended to express the joyousness which was to be a leading characteristic of the pilgrim feasts. Indeed, the rabbis expressly mention these 3 as marking the great festivals, that is, presence or appearance at Jerusalem, the appointed festive offerings of the worshippers, which are not to be confounded with the public sacrifices offered on these occasions in the name of the whole congregation, and joyousness with which they connect the freewill offerings that each brought as the Lord had blessed them, and which afterwards were shared with the poor, the desolate, and the Levite, in the joyous meal that followed the public services of the temple. To these general characteristics of the 3 great feasts, we ought, perhaps, to add in regard to all festive seasons, that each was to be a holy convocation, or gathering for sacred purposes, the injunction of rest from servile, or else from all work, and, lastly, certain special sacrifices which were to be brought in the name of the whole congregation. Besides the Mosaic festivals, the Jews celebrated at the time of Christ 2 other feasts, that of Esther or Purim, and that of the dedication of the temple on its restoration by Judas the Maccabee. Certain minor observances and the public fasts in memory of the great national calamities will be noticed in the sequel. Private fasts would, of course, depend on individuals, but the strict Pharisees were wont to fast every Monday and Thursday during the weeks intervening between the Passover and Pentecost, and again between the Feast of Tabernacles and that of the dedication of the temple. It is to this practice that the Pharisee in the parable refers, Luke 18:12, when boasting, "I fast twice in the week." 3 annual visits to temple. The duty of appearing 3 times a year in the temple applied to all male Israelites, bondsmen, the deaf, dumb, and lame, those whom sickness, infirmity, or age, rendering incapable of going on foot up the mountain of the house, and, of course, all in a state of Levitical uncleanness, being accepted. In general, the duty of appearing before the Lord at the services of his house was deemed paramount. Here, an important rabbinical principle came in, which, although not expressed in scriptures, seems clearly founded upon it, that a sacrifice could not be offered for anyone unless he himself were present, to present and to lay his hand upon it. It followed that, as the morning and evening sacrifices, and those on feast days were purchased with money, contributed by all, and offered on behalf of the whole congregation, all Israel should have attended these services. This was manifestly impossible, but to represent the people, 24 courses of lay attendance were appointed, corresponding to those of the priests and the Levites. These were the stationary men, or men of the station, or standing men, from their standing there in the temple as Israel's representatives. For clearness' sake, we repeat that each of these courses had its head and served for 1 week, those of the station on service, who did not appear in Jerusalem, meeting in a central synagogue of their district and spending the time in fasting and prayer for their brethren. On the day before the Sabbath, on the Sabbath itself, and on the day following, they did not fast on account of the joy of the Sabbath. Each day they read a portion of Scripture, the first and second chapters of Genesis being for this purpose arranged into sections for the week. This practice, which tradition traced up to Samuel and David, was of ancient date. But the men of the station did not impose hands on either the morning or evening sacrifice, nor on any other public offering. Their duty was twofold: to represent all Israel in the services of the sanctuary, and to act as a sort of guide to those who had business in the temple. Thus, at a certain point of the service, the head of the course brought up those who had come to make an atonement on being cleansed from any impurity, and ranged them along the gate of Nicanor in readiness for the ministry of the officiating priests. The men of the station were dispensed from attendance in the temple on all occasions when the Hallel was chanted, possibly because the responses of the people when the hymn was sung showed that they needed no formal representatives. Difficulties of the calendar. Hitherto we have not adverted to the difficulties which those who intended to appear in Jerusalem at the feast would experience from the want of any fixed calendar. As the year of the Hebrews was lunar, not solar, it consisted of only 354 days, 8 hours, 48 minutes, 38 seconds. This, distributed among 12 months, would in the course of years have completely disoriented the months, so that the first month, or Nisan, corresponding to the end of March or the beginning of April, in the middle of which the first ripe barley was to be presented to the Lord, might have fallen in the middle of winter. Accordingly, the Sanhedrin appointed a committee of 3, of which the chief of the Sanhedrin was always president, and which, if not unanimous, might be increased to 7, when a majority of voices would suffice to determine which year was to be made a leap year by the insertion of a 13th month. Their resolution was generally taken in the 12th month, Adar, the additional or 13th month being inserted between the 12th and the 1st. A sabbatical year could not be a leap year, but that preceding it always was such. Sometimes 2, but never 3, leap years succeeded each other. Commonly, every third year required the addition of a month, the mean duration of the Jewish month being 29 days, 12 hours, 43 minutes, 3 and 1/3 seconds. It required, during a period of 19 years, the insertion of 7 months to bring the lunar era in accordance with the Julian. The new moon. And this brings up yet another difficulty. The Jews calculated the month according to the phases of the moon, each month consisting of either 29 or 30 days, and beginning with the appearance of the new moon. But this opened a fresh field of uncertainty. It is quite true that everyone might observe for himself the appearance of a new moon, but this would again partly depend on the state of the weather. Besides, it left an authoritative declaration of the commencement of a month unsupplied. And yet not only was the first of every month to be observed as New Moon's Day, but the feast took place on the 10th, 15th, or other day of the month, which could not be accurately determined without a certain knowledge of its beginning. To supply this want, the Sanhedrin sat in the hall of polished stones to receive the testimony of credible witnesses that they had seen the new moon. To encourage as many as possible to come forward on so important a testimony, these witnesses were handsomely entertained at the public expense. If the new moon had appeared at the commencement of the 30th day, which would correspond to our evening of the 29th, as the Jews reckoned the day from evening to evening, the Sanhedrin declared the previous month to have been one of 29 days, or imperfect. Immediately thereon, men were sent to a signal station on the Mount of Olives, where beacon fires were lit and torches waved, till a kindling flame on a hill in the distance indicated that the signal had been perceived. Thus the tidings that this was the new moon would be carried from hill to hill, far beyond the boundaries of Palestine, to those of the dispersion beyond the river. Again, if credible witnesses had not appeared to testify to the appearances of the new moon on the evening of the 29th, the next evening, or that of the 30th, according to our reckoning, was taken as the commencement of the new month, in which case the previous month was declared to have been one of 30 days, or full. It was ruled that a year should neither have less than 4 nor more than 8 such full months of 30 days. The 7 messengers of the new moon. But these early fire signals opened the way for serious inconvenience. The enemies of the Jews lit beacons to deceive those at a distance, and it became necessary to send special messengers to announce the new moon. These were, however, dispatched only 7 times in the year, just in time for the various feasts. In Nisan, for the Passover on the 15th, and in the following month, for the second Passover, kept by those who had been debarred from the first, in the 5th month, for the fast on the 9th, on account of the destruction of Jerusalem, in the 6th month, on account of the approaching solemnities of Tishri, in the 7th month, for its festivals, in the 9th month, for the feast of dedication of the temple, and in Adar for Purim. Thus, practically, all difficulties were removed except in reference to the month Elul, since as the new moon of the following month, or Tishri, was the Feast of Trumpets, it would be exceedingly important to know in time whether Elul had 29 or 30 days. But here the rabbis ruled that Elul should be regarded as a month of 29 days, unless a message to the contrary were received, that indeed, since the days of Ezra, it had always been so, and that, accordingly, New Year's Day would be the same day after the 29th of Elul. To make, however, assurance doubly sure, it soon became the practice to keep New Year's Day on 2 successive days, and this has since been extended into a duplication of all the great feast days, of course with the exception of fasts, and that, although the calendar has long been fixed, an error is therefore no more possible. Names of the Hebrew months. The present Hebrew names of the months are variously supposed to be derived from the Chaldee or from the Persian language. they certainly do not appear before the return from Babylon. Before that, the months were named only after their numbers, or else from the natural phenomena characteristic of the seasons, as sprouting, green ears for the first, splendor, flowering for the second, rain for the eighth, and flowing rivers for the seventh. The division of the year into ecclesiastical, which commenced with the month of Nisan, the end of March or beginning of April, or about the spring equinox, and civil, which commenced with the seventh month, or Tishri, corresponding to the autumn equinox, has by many likewise been supposed to have only originated after the return from Babylon. But the analogy of the twofold arrangement of weights, measures, and money into civil and sacred, and other notices seem against this view. And it is more likely that from the first the Jews distinguished the civil year, which began in Tishri, from the ecclesiastical, which commenced in Nisan, from which month, as the first, all others were counted. To this twofold division the rabbis add that for tithing the herds and flocks, the year was reckoned from Elul to Elul, and for taxing fruits, often from Shabbat to Shabbat. The eras used by the Jews. The earliest era adopted by the Jews was that which was reckoned to commence with the deliverance from Egypt. During the reigns of the Jewish kings, time was computed from the year of their accession to the throne. After their return from exile, the Jews dated their years according to the Seleucid era, which began 312 BC, or 3450 from the creation of the world. For a short time after the War of Independence, it became necessary to reckon dates from the year of the liberation of Palestine. However, for a very long period after the destruction of Jerusalem, probably till the 12th century AD, the Seleucid era remained in common use, when it finally gave place to the present mode of reckoning among the Jews, which dates from the creation of the world. To commute the Jewish year into that of our common era, we have to add to the latter 3761, always bearing in mind, however, that the common or civil Jewish year commences in the month of Tishra, i.e., in autumn. The week. The week was divided into 7 days, of which, however, only the seventh, the Sabbath, had a name assigned to it, the rest being merely noted by numerals. The day was computed from sunset to sunset, or rather, to the appearance of the first three stars with which a new day commenced. Before the Babylonish captivity, it was divided into morning, midday, evening, and night. But during the residence in Babylon, the Hebrews adopted the division of the day into 12 hours, whose duration varied with the length of the day. The longest day consisted of 14 hours and 12 minutes, the shortest of 9 hours and 48 minutes, the difference between the two being thus more than 4 hours. On the average, the first hour of the day corresponded nearly to our 6 a.m., the third hour, when according to Matthew 20, verse 3, the marketplace was full, to our 9 a.m., the close of the sixth hour to our midday, while at the 11th, the day neared its close. The Romans reckoned the hours from midnight, a fact which explains the apparent discrepancy between John 19:14, where, at the sixth hour of the Roman calculation, Pilate brings Jesus out to the Jews, while at the third hour of the Jewish, and hence the ninth hour of the Roman, and of our calculation, Mark 15:25, he was led forth to be crucified. The night was divided by the Romans into four, by the Jews into three watches. The Jews subdivided the hour into 1,080 parts, and again, each part into 76 moments.